Hiya, welcome to another episode of Zero Ambitions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. So this week, Jeff and I are in conversation with architects Harry Brown and Seamus Guidera of RKD in Dublin. I think this is probably going to be one of quite a few conversations that we have about a new or rather different aspect of retrofit. So the retrofit of commercial space, offices, retail, etc. We talk an awful lot about housing, the home, social housing, but we don't really talk about this aspect, and it is one that takes up a massive amount of the built environment, literally and figuratively. We were introduced to Harry and Seamus through Dr. Richard O'Hegarty, who joined us last year for our episode about counting carbon and how long a building should last with Oliver Canaan. And Richard mentioned he had some friends, a practice he works at, who were doing some research into the subject. So since sometime after that, we've been in contact, just trying to flesh out a few ideas, see what was going on, and yeah, see what we could do in terms of putting an episode together. When it's interesting, this is a subject, strictly speaking, we don't know enough about. So we wanted to speak with people who have a bit more experience working with a different kind of asset owner. It was really interesting because these are architects who are not driven by sustainability in the same way a lot of the people that we speak to are. It is a factor, obviously, but these guys are thinking about what can make offices more viable spaces in terms of like placemaking, not just warehousing office workers. To us, it's an interesting subject because it feels like talking about homes, houses, it's a lot easier. We've got a lot of the answers, but because it's a commercial endeavor, it's a bit more complicated. And because it's complicated, it's easy to ignore. Too hard, isn't it? I mean, this is something that came up in our conversation with Alex Hedesu of NSA of Capital last year. And if you're listed, Jeff, yes, I did get a name wrong. I'm sorry. Man, we were very tired. I've been recovering from a cold and Jeff's up against it. So if you detect us being a bit low energy, that explains why. Anyway, for us, it was a really interesting, meandering conversation, thinking about taking a asset like that and making it more resilient, given that we know how vulnerable that whole ecosystem is to shocks like COVID and that. It's not as straightforward as it used to be. So I won't keep you. Thank you for joining us. Oh, sorry. And just before you go, there were two notes that I had to include, just in case anyone's not aware. M&E refers to mechanical and electrical services. So getting all that stuff into the building. A Cat A fit out is referred to quite a lot. So for anyone that doesn't know, that's the basic fixtures and fittings, like lighting, air conditioning, ceilings, floors, just the basics that you have to have in there. And there's a massive chance that all that stuff gets ripped out after someone moves in. Right, I'll let you go now. Cheers. Yeah. So how's business? Oh, here we go.
There he is.
There we go. Was it?
Yeah, business is good. We've been pretty flat out since we last spoke. When did we last speak? Was it?
It was September.
It was September. God.
Yeah, that long. Yeah,
like we thought it was a few weeks ago. Yeah.
Last, I sent you an email at the end of January to apologise.
Yeah.
For not arranging something, and then didn't arrange anything until last week. This week, Jesus.
Until yesterday.
It's funny. I apologize a lot for things. There's an Irish thing. I guess there's a British thing to do on this. Not so much with you usually, Dan, actually.
No, not me. No.
No, yeah. But you know that kind of the apologizing for.
Yeah.
You always ruin the apology.
Yeah. I worked in London for a year and I had to tell myself to stop. Say excuse me rather than sorry.
They're the ones who need to apologize. You know.
Apologies for that.
How's it going?
Another apology. We were just saying
we apologize.
We all apologize too much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a strange thing. You can devalue the apology, but sure, we all do it, you know.
Just to give you a bit of background, we started talking about research that they've been working on, projects they've delivered, and the experience they've had supporting their clients, because you guys have been producing a bunch of research.
I should say as well, and whether I say this now or not, well, I'm saying it, so I guess that was that settled that one. Was I've been talking to Neil Menzies in Hibernia. Yeah. Because I got a press release months ago, which I failed to act on. And the other day in trying to go through my appalling hellscape of an inbox, I found this press release had got about One Cumberland Place, which so, I see is one of your jobs.
Well, it's the job was by another architect, the retrofit job, but Hibernia and our colleague Richard O'Hegarty.
Good guy.
So Richard and Neil actually ran that case study on the building for Hibernia. So Hibernia commissioned RKD after the job was done to do a research case study piece on the performance of the building and how to drive towards net zero. So yeah, we can definitely.
So you're going around. Are you going around marking other architects' work now?
No. It's clearly states that it was not. No. We're quite careful to make sure it's.
Well, look, it's more than marking the homework. Checking the performance of.
It actually was to further add to the performance. So there's a company called Symphony Engineering. I don't know if you know it. A guy called Tom Askoff, he used to work in Arup, and he set up this company. It's about driving the performance. So that building was already performing at LEED Platinum, and they further drove the performance by another 70 or 80% towards
it. What does performing at LEED Platinum mean?
Good question. What does net zero mean?
Is it performative?
So even the definition of net zero they concluded was inconclusive.
One that I love to use here again and again in the podcast concept of net zero murder. So for a murderer to be net zero murderer, what you do is for every person you slaughter, you conceive someone else. Yeah.
So it's good that you mentioned Richard, because Richard O'Hegarty, he was our introduction from the episode he joined us on last year with...
Oliver Finan.
Yeah. They are listeners to the podcast, so shout out Richard and Oliver. So today we're talking about non-domestic real estate, buildings, for a change, because, well, we've got to be in our bonnet about them, I think. They are... a subject which is under-considered in the discourse. Like, no one talks about it, hardly. And there's little incentive to do better. So, when Richard said he had some colleagues at RKD Architects in Dublin who were researching this stuff, we said, can you please introduce us, please? We would really like to talk to them. And he did. So, we are here with Harry Brown and... Seamus, what's your surname, Seamus? Sorry, I can't see.
Vaidera Perkiwan.
But I wasn't even just going to try and avoid flubbing your surname. I just couldn't find it in front of me.
Okay.
But I would be inclined to get it wrong because I am so English as Jeff.
French name, anyway.
Yeah. No, not even close. Tipperary.
But we'd be inclined to get the French names wrong, anything a bit too foreign. So tell us, Harry, Seamus, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. And great to be here. And thanks for the introduction, Richard.
So you guys, would you mind giving us a bit of a background on what RKD is as a practice? Like what you guys do there?
Yeah, absolutely. RKD are one of the larger architecture-only practices in Ireland. And we would be working across mostly the industrial, commercial, and also a little bit of public sector. Myself and Seamus would be more closer to the commercial side of things, and we would generally be, you know, in the good old days, 5-10 years ago, doing mostly shell and core offices. And the landscape, as you say, is kind of changing. And so we've noticed a bit of a shift, I suppose, that's been driven by the Energy Performance Building Directive and sustainability requirements, ESG, all of that. What we're seeing is that I heard a fact recently that 80% of the buildings that need to be net zero by 2050 are already built. So therein lies quite a significant problem with all of the existing building stock that's, I suppose, becoming less desirable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot of basket case stuff there. And a lot of, you know, we've coined the term, and Dan's been trying to popularize it, oil age architecture. So how you deal with the glass and steel boxes that architects have been so into for so long, how you deal with them from a retrofit perspective is a fascinating challenge. I know we're talking also about a lot of, you know, more prosaic, you know, commercial is such a wide variety of kind of buildings, you know, and building uses that cover this. I'd be fascinated to know how you approach that and how you reconcile the architectural tropes and the established ways of doing things, you know, with the need to retrofit, and how you do it without ruining, in the eyes of many people, you know, great architecture.
I think there's probably a fundamental shift in perceptions as to wanting new things, and that doesn't just go for buildings, that's sort of for everything. But you know, we, over the past maybe 10 years with the offices that have been built in Dublin, they've been new glass blocks. And, you know, what they may have been lacking in terms of something unique or identifiable, now is a good opportunity to provide that. So it's sort of like a perfect storm of all of these different things. By refurbing, we can obtain a huge quantum of carbon, and we can also offer something that's different, and it's a good news story. So there's a bit of a tipping point in that we have, you know, a challenging planning system that makes demolition very difficult, rightly so. We also have the carbon implications of demolishing buildings, and we have the opportunity to sort of redefine what an office is. And I think there's a really sort of positive story in that offices and companies get to rethink what their office is about, who they are, where they're situated, and what happens in their office. It's not just a big building with lots of desks. You know, it's a chance to sort of rethink, take a step back and say, well, hang on a second, we're still a really important global company, but we want our office to be a physical, you know, embodiment of who we are and our culture. And, you know, retaining a building is a really good way of doing that, as well as all of the other
companies. Yeah. And I think what's really interesting about it is that there's kind of the macro scale and the micro scale that we spoke about, and I suppose the opportunity for placemaking that the building creates for a neighborhood. So there's the attractiveness of the office building so that people will go to it, because if it's not attractive, most people are going to continue to work from home. They're going to decide not to go in. But then outside the building, you know, what's happening on the street? Is there shops around? Is there nice restaurants around? Is there amenities like gyms and things like that? Where, you know, the feels like the business park of the previous era is kind of dying, and it's really just driving towards the need for mixed use neighborhoods at a faster pace.
It's interesting seeing how something is evolving. Like this case for mixed use, we discussed it with Alex Zaidu of NSA Capital.
And SEO, I think, is her surname. Yes, Zaidu. Where did you get that from? You were wrong. That's the main
Fine.
Thing.
But there is a risk growing within the market that assets are going to become stranded. Or there is increasing risk of creating stranded assets, or asset owners finding themselves with stranded assets. So there is this, there is the risk which is being created by the minimum energy performance standard, MEPS, regulations incoming by 2030, because any commercial space with an EPC below B, this is in the UK, is going to find itself unlettable. And this is a situation in which 77% of UK office stock currently has an EPC rating below B.
Yeah, and I think we found that I think it's actually 85% of offices in Ireland which are below the BER rating, which I believe is the equivalent to that. As you said, not as many people are talking about it because the focus has really been on housing. And there's a bit of a funny narrative going on at the moment about how you can convert all these old offices into housing, which, I mean, to our minds, probably doesn't seem like a big grand solution to the housing crisis. Most of those buildings could, you know, some of them could be converted, but it's probably more money than it's worth. And they're really probably suited to be upgraded into better office buildings, which, as we're saying, we don't think the office is dead. It's just a bit of a seminal moment.
Well, there seems to be this sort of febrile environment for the office, because in the UK, we're seeing HSBC moving out of Canary Wharf. So they're ditching their Canada Square office, which I think lots of people would be delighted with because it was a horrible office to go to.
They're moving into a refurbed office, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, this is what I find interesting. That was highlighted as this massive shift. But like when I was working with the finance sector, like HSBC was one of my clients. And so I used to go to their offices. They had some really nice offices. I think it was the Tory Party headquarters formerly. So it was like really ornate, old England stuff. Interesting experiencing it. So they ditched that and moved everyone into Canada Square, hot desking. So they were trying to keep people home for part of the week and get them into the office for the rest of the week. And like other players like that, Fidelity International, long before COVID, they've been scaling back their office footprint, getting rid of offices, encouraging hot desking, getting people to work from home, getting people to work from regional offices. So there's been this weird trend that we've seen, like most recently manifesting Meta just ditching their lease. They paid $150 million to ditch the lease on their central office. But at the same time, you've got a company like Apple moving into Battersea Power Station.
And then you see companies like, is it Deutsche Bank that are mandating all their staff to go back because they realize that the value of their assets are going down if they are not going into the office.
Well, this is it. JP Morgan did the same. Everyone back into the office. Apple has mandated a minimum 3 days a week. So this is being monitored. The register is being kept.
Mm.
I noticed that Janus Henderson Investors, like a former client from way back, their CEO posted this interesting blog post, like from, you know, macro investment perspective, where the key takeaways in summary were employers are now pushing employees to be in the office more often. And we are actually seeing that. Like there was that massive shift towards people feeling like they could expect hybrid working or work from home. But like the rise in interest rates and the cost of living seems to have shifted the balance of power. So employers can be much more demanding than they were being.
Interesting you mentioned the interest rates, because the interest rates seem to also on the other end be holding back potential new development or even the refurb opportunities, because the money to do it is more expensive. So there's a little bit of a hesitancy there, as well as the on the flip side, you're saying that it's putting the employers in the driving seat.
Yeah. Well, this is the other thing. So I saw that article in the Irish Business Post.
It's not called the Irish Business Post.
For an English audience, Jeff. The headline, it was Colm Lauder's article. All of this will be in the show notes. Early evidence shows investors can win from green office refurbs. Just a quick quote from the article. There's clearly a growing appetite for more creative, value-added asset management of older offices in major cities like London, Dublin, and elsewhere. However, with the traditional institutions often lacking the skill sets or the appetites to drive a major redevelopment and refurbishment agenda, such opportunities are likely to be availed of by sector specialists. That's you fellas, presumably.
Yeah.
And this is because, like, portfolio values, as you alluded to, Deutsche Bank, etc., because of this shift in how people are using offices, commercial lettings, being a bit shaky, less certain, the portfolio values that used to be increased by creating new assets are falling because they're not creating new assets, and the intrinsic like return on investment is diminished. It is less reliable, less certain. There's this risk of stranded assets incoming. So the natural response to this situation has been to shore up the value of the assets that they do have through retrofit.
Yeah, but it's still a risk, isn't it? Like, I suppose, bigger picture, you're shoring up the value of the asset, and the nature of the property market in Ireland would still be the one that takes the risk and then awaits a tenant to come on board. So what we're seeing in some projects is sort of early engagement from the tenant, which gives everybody, you know, a little bit of comfort to move ahead and do that. And then the other thing is that the truth of it is, building an office, architecturally or from a contractor's point of view or from a design team point of view, from scratch is relatively easy compared to refurbing it. It's an endless, you know, it's almost seen as an open checkbook sometimes when you start a big refurb project. How far do you want to go? What are the parameters and how much do you actually want to refurb? And the cost can be comparable to a new build if you're going for a deep retrofit on a building. So it tends to be probably a trickier start to a project when you're actually trying to find the brief and saying, what's the output here? Because a lot of the time, we can go into a 20-year-old building and say, you know, let's change all the M&E kit and let's, I don't know, jazz it up a little bit with new carpets and ceiling. But then you're going, it still looks the same. So then you have the sort of the more subjective side to it. How do we create what might feel like a new building or give tenants what they want without sort of blowing the bank or without replacing the glazing when it doesn't need to be replaced? So there's a lot of back and forth. It's a complex process to get those projects started. They're really fun projects and they're sort of rewarding projects, but I just think it's not as easy. I think we probably aren't pretty good for quite a while building new offices from scratch. And now herein lies the challenge, and I think the value for architects as well, to be able to sort of talk to the clients and the tenants and say, what really matters? You know, I think it's more than just M&E kit. There's things like end-of-trip facilities that sort of enable the story around sustainability and active travel. And, you know, there's lots of little bits that go into these new buildings, and they're complicated.
You're kind of alluding to it, Dan, when you're speaking about the ones who are going to take the opportunity from this. And what we're seeing is it's the asset owners that are savvy enough to do the development, that know how to develop and understand their buildings well. They're talking to their tenants now more and more. It's not just building space and the tenants will come. The gap is being bridged, I suppose, between tenant and landlord, and that ultimately has to be a good thing from a building perspective and from a sustainability perspective, because the tenant as well as the landlord are working together to try and get towards more sustainable, towards net zero buildings. So it seems like it's a positive thing that's happened overall, and then the opportunity is in they are more complicated buildings, but then how do you try to, I suppose, if you have the tenant on board, then maybe you can not do the Cat A fit out that's going to get ripped out anyway. And then there's overall cost savings that can be invested back into the quality and the architecture and the space. So there's kind of, hopefully, what we're seeing is kind of knock on effect there.
I wanted to ask something as well here, just around this point about the shell and core versus the fit out. Because we come across it that when we feature non-domestic buildings, that you've got different design teams for the two things, and on the kind of bigger projects. And you hear stories about complete dysfunction in terms of lack of integration, a lack of consideration of what was done at shell and core stage in terms of making the building work for the tenant. Are you encountering any of that? Is that an issue that you run into? And is it something that you think we can do better at?
We can do much better. We've been lucky to be involved on both sides of the table on a few jobs recently, and we tend to sort of pitch for jobs having expertise in fit out and shell and core. But as you say, like the positives can be massive, because there's design decisions that are made by a shell and core team that can make the job of the fit out architect and contractor a nightmare, or can make it very easy, save everybody money, save everybody carbon. And all it takes is that early engagement. So I think historically there's probably been a bit of sort of a combative approach to client developer versus tenant, but it's definitely changed in the last couple of years. There's a good example in Dublin with IPUT and A&L Goodbody on the Keys, and you know, that early engagement, talking to the tenant, seeing what they want. It's no longer build it and they will come. There has to be a bit of a discussion, I think, about what the tenants actually want going forward. As Harry said, there's a lot of providing a Cat A fit out. So raised access floor, suspended ceilings on every floor of a building. And the purpose of that is so that the developer can walk a potential tenant around the building, and so they can visualize what their office space might look like. And that's just mental when you think of how easy it would be to show a CGI, pop on a VR headset and save. It could be tens of millions in a large building. So there's still a lot of developers Cat A-ing, if that's a verb, their entire building at massive expense, just to then take it out a year or two later. And I can't believe that's happening so much still.
I mean, the embodied carbon waste of that as well. What happens to the material that gets taken out then?
The skip.
The good old skip.
Just a bit of a sidetrack. I was chatting to a guy just before this meeting, a glazing manufacturer. We're talking about glass recycling. And it's something we've spoken to clients about and demolition contractors about. And it's happening. And it's a bit of a no-brainer. But like all of these ways to save carbon or cost or a little bit of sort of common sense at an early stage, it's as simple as taking the cullet, you know, away, the manufacturer then using it as their aggregate and literally creating new glass, and they're saving about 30% on the embodied carbon of the entire glazed unit. It doesn't cost anything. It actually saves money, because what you're doing is you're reducing the cost of raw material going into the glass itself. So like the solutions are simple. The challenge, I think, is implementing it across various consultants and contractors and clients at various stages. So in the example of glass, you're ensuring that a demolition contractor is able to remove the glass, look after it, bag it up, smash it correctly, and hand it back to the glazing recycler, who can then hand it to the glazing manufacturer. So all of these things are easy, I think, to fix. They just need a little bit of joined up thinking, and they just need to make it as sort of palatable as possible for the client at the end of the day. And if it's a money saver on top of a carbon saver, then you're laughing.
So, but what feels most absurd in all of this is how little forethought has gone into the construction of these spaces at all to begin with. Like the economic imperative is such that building something for a single purpose, then when that purpose is finished, well, knock it down, get rid of it and build a new thing. That has been the cycle.
It seems like that was the narrative of buildings for the last, I don't know, few hundred years, or at least, well,
yeah, that's Oil Age architecture.
Since the more modern times, because I think people didn't mind knocking a lot of them down because they're a bit uglier. Whereas our historic buildings tend to be protected. That's the way that things have been done. It's you build the building, you maximize its use over 60 years, and then you knock it down and you rebuild. But that narrative now seems to be changing, and it's changing both from a policy perspective and then also now from the landlord-tenant perspective. Everybody's kind of copping on or waking up to that isn't such a good idea.
Yeah,
but I think
it's not like people haven't been saying this for years, though. Like Bill Bordas and Adrian Lehman, former guests. Do you remember when we had them on, Jeff, the first time?
Yeah.
They were talking about finding it ridiculous that buildings were designed for a single purpose rather than a building being designed as a shell that can be used for multi-purpose, that can be designed to be used for 100 years, yeah. Like and reused.
If you look at George and Dublin's a great example of buildings that have gone through many different lifespans. I mean, yeah. They were built as glamorous houses for rich people originally, and then they ended up being slum houses at one point in time, and now most of them are offices or have restaurants in them. So that's a great example of buildings that have gone through many different, I suppose, uses or lives over their period of existence. And then actually probably the preference from the city is for a lot of them to go back into housing in some shape or form rather than an office. But what allows that, I think, is good quality design. The fact that there is tall floor to ceilings in most of those buildings makes them quite attractive, and they're quite glamorous rooms. So I think the quality of the design encourages the longevity of the architecture.
But I just say I presume you're not evangelizing for a Prince Charles style, as John Moorhead put it, architectural karaoke, imitating stuff from the past. You do want to produce something that shows that we were here as well, right? Don't you?
It's a funny one, because on one hand, we're saying that we're designing buildings to last longer. You know, there's merit in that. We're saying this building isn't going to be knocked down in 30 years' time, like a lot of the buildings that were built in Ireland in the 70s and 80s. So we're designing for 60 to 100 years, but then we're also trying to add in that flexibility for future use. But we don't know what that flexible future use may be. And there's an added carbon and financial cost to designing that flexibility in. So one user group that we've all heard a lot about is life sciences and labs. And a lot of clients may say, you know, might be an office, it might be life science, it might be single tenant, it might be multiple tenants. And there is a limit to how flexible you can make a building without just sort of trying to keep everybody happy and, you know, adding in too much to allow that future flexibility. I think, as Harry says, the main thing, decent floor to ceilings, decent aspect, those things sort of lend themselves to flexibility in the future. If we look back, I'd say, you know, probably accidentally George and Dublin turned into offices. I can't imagine it was envisaged that they'd be offices. 1970s, 1980s offices in Dublin are actually quite well suited to apartment layouts, not because of their floor to ceiling, just because of their sort of 18 meter wide span. But again, they never would have been designed with that intent. The offices that we've seen in the last 10 or 15 years, I think, as it currently stands, are less flexible for residential conversion based on their deep floor plates and the size of their atria. But I suppose we just don't know what that flexibility will look like at the end of their lifespan. I think it's an interesting point, though.
Another thing I think comes back to urban planning. I mean, like those 70s, 80s office blocks, usually they were designed around car-based development. And I mean, that was the big problem since the 50s that car-based development really took over. So they usually have an undercroft parking or designed so that most people could drive there. So I think it's interesting when you look at it in the wider context of the city and urban design. A city I always love is Amsterdam. There aren't skyscrapers everywhere, but they have modern development and they've old development all mixed in together. And a lot of their buildings get reused and repurposed over the years, I would say. But their city's designed around quite a compact urban block that has streets and parks, and it's designed for people to walk, not cars. And I think that helps allow buildings to be more multifunctional, more multi-use.
Yeah, well, I think the purpose of an awful lot of development in the UK and Ireland, like with the Celtic Tiger, etc., has been just assets to be bought and sold. Like the use of them was a moot point. What the people involved in the process knew was they could maximize the value of the land asset that they held by sticking something on it. What that was, that's a mere detail. What's the thing that will turn it, increase the value of this asset the most? I'll do that. Yeah. Something that stood out to me that was interesting is you said you're designing buildings for 60 to 100 year lifespan. When we normally speak with developers of any sort, they're only comfortable publicly speaking towards that 60 year target with a tacit acknowledgement that you build it right, it'll last forever. Like we had the same conversation with the Irish Timber Frame Manufacturers Association, not a public one, like a private one, last week where this came up. Is this part of your natural process, taking that long-term view, or is this part of the process that you offer to your clients?
In fairness, the 60 to 100-year lifespan is a client-driven request. There's been a lot of sort of back and forth, and this is a decision made due to a greening of their portfolio. And to design a building as a sort of a benchmark within their portfolio, it was seen as a bit of a test case. So they asked us, what does a 100-year building look like? As you say, with the knowledge that it'll likely last a lot longer, hopefully. But it was an interesting challenge, and I suppose it got us thinking about that future flexibility piece, future expansion or reduction of the building to open up or to change the use. Now, it was done at a fairly high level that, like, you're talking about refurbing it in 60 years into a future use. So really it was about highlighting how that may happen. Can slabs be taken out? Can floors be added? We looked at apartments within it and how they may fit into that. But again, it's at a very high level because we don't know what an apartment will look like in 60 years.
Are you thinking as well? I can't resist talking about this when we talk about, you know, looking forward 60 years or whatever. But are you thinking about, do you consider climate scenarios, future climate scenarios, in terms of any modeling that you may be doing? And if so, I mean, the thing that has thrown me into despair on this to a certain extent is the recent research on the Atlantic Meridian ocean current, the Gulf Stream system potentially reaching a tipping point, and, you know, the risk of climate in Europe profoundly changing, not necessarily getting warmer and wetter, potentially getting much colder, you know, given that we've got the same latitude here as Labrador in Canada and, you know, Moscow.
Yeah, I don't look forward to that. Well, maybe flooding is an interesting one, and that comes up a lot in projects. Flooding is interesting because it seems like every year we have our 1 in 100 year flood, and flood defense systems have been designed in a lot of, say, 21st century office buildings or buildings to a defined datum. And what that does in a public realm sense is that it can really sterilize the street and the activity on the street. And it also limits the extent of actual future flood defense that it provides the building. So with a sort of a mixture of solid and demountable systems, you're hopefully allowing for, it doesn't mean that you're plunking in the 3 meter high defense system every time there's a small flood, but you're allowing some flexibility for, you know, you're envisaging a higher datum in sort of the decades ahead to respond to that, changing the use in those lower floors as well. So typically, you know, we'd have very little office use in a building on ground or lower ground. We'd keep all of our end of trip facilities, which is growing massively in terms of what tenants expect. So I think it is changing inherently. Less to do with climate, to be honest, from what we're seeing.
So are clients, are they even thinking about climate?
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, when we're talking with some social housing providers, Exeter, for instance, that Jeff cited on the episode that went out last week, how far ahead are their climate projections?
They use 2080 climate files, and I think they use extreme climate change files when they're designing their buildings. The passive house standards using 2080 data. Yeah.
No, to be honest, a lot of our clients sometimes are ahead of us in terms of their research. I mean, we're talking about Hibernia and Neil Menzies earlier. I mean, our sustainability team have collaborated with them on a few things, and yeah, they're quite ahead of the game in terms of how they're thinking about climate and sustainability. They own their assets, so they have to think about it. You know, sometimes the developer that's looking to do a deal and then flip it on, less so, but at the same time, anybody that they're looking to sell the building to, they know is looking at it as well. So it's hard not to these days.
So the ones who are taking a long-term view are holding on to the asset and maximizing the value of the asset. They're the ones taking an actual long-term view. But we've still got instances like, again, in the UK. So I think it was last week or the week before where it was announced that the Marks and Spencers building that was going to be knocked down, that magnificent building, had received a stay of execution and it wasn't going to be knocked down. Now they've received, I think it was the High Court said that, nah, lads, crack on. Like, we can't stop you because Michael
Gove. What are they rebuilding in its place? Something very similar.
Well, yeah. Oh, the most sustainable Marks and Spencers that has ever lived, apparently.
Right. Glass phallus, probably. I don't know.
Yeah.
with a large embodied carbon.
But this is the irony. Like, I don't understand. In fact, no, I do understand how they can make that claim, because they don't have to make it in good faith, do they? They just have to say it. They explicitly said this will be an opportunity to build the most sustainable Marks and Spencers.
It reminded me of when, was it Bloomberg built their new LEED Platinum building in London? Did it win the Sterling Prize?
It did. It got a bit of backlash, I think, in some of the articles that it was a brand new building and it replaced a similar site, something like that.
I think Nick Grant, who's like one of the top pacifist consultants in the UK and famous for being a man of you know, who gets to the point and quite brutally at times in a lovely way. He basically he said that, because it was being described as a zero carbon building or something like that. It was nonsensical like that. Nick basically said when he looked at the budget for it, and it was something ridiculous. I can't remember the build cost, but it was enormous, well over 10,000 per square meter. I can't remember. He said that a high cost building cannot be a low carbon building because of the carbon that has to be emitted for all the economic activity required to pay for it. You know, it's a curious one.
There's a bit of a gap in the, you know, I think the communication from, if we go back to, say, the demolition contractor and who gets the kudos for doing all that good stuff at an early stage. So, you know, you recycle a bit of glass, buildings demolished. A year later, they start building a new building on site. The developer then sells the new building to a fund. The fund then finds a tenant and the tenant moves in. Like, it's a little bit of a stretch and we sort of need to join that up so that the tenant can say, I'm occupying a building. The building that was demolished, we recycle 40%. Or, you know, there needs to be that, like, you need to capture all of that good kudos and really give it to the tenant at the end of the day, because I think that's missing at the moment as well. It's very easy to move into a new building with fantastic operational carbon accreditations and forget about what came before.
But do we need to express this in the architecture too? I mean, I'm always going on as well about, in the show, it's a very easy one to mention because they're the poster boys of this, but Lacaton and Vassal, when they won the Pritzker Prize, it was just a rare ray of hope, I suppose, in the sense that you have an architect that's trying to argue for doing less, avoiding interventions where you can. And then some of their buildings, like the Palais de Tokyo or whatever, that where you've got these, where they've taken all of the imperfections or whatever of the existing building and expressed that as part of the architecture. Is that what if we're talking about moving from an oil age architecture to an Anthropocene architecture, I think of RKD as a practice that has got impressive design chops. But is that your thoughts on this? I think would be very interesting to me. What does Anthropocene architecture look like?
Well, Anthropocene architecture is oil age. We're looking to move beyond that. Anthropocene refers to the
okay. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, sorry.
That's all right.
We're moving from the postmodern era into the metamodern era or something like that, where it's all about integrating biodiversity and people, and rather than architecture trying to imitate nature, it's actually trying to integrate it. Or I think what you're talking about is just being a bit more pragmatic and actually weighing up the financial cost, but there's a carbon cost and we're now going to need to start calculating that in our design.
But that's it. Like, the oil age architecture refers to one, buildings built with oil in terms of like easy access to concrete because it's cheap to make compared to in Roman times when we had Kelly Alvarez Doran, the half climate design architect and consultant, on the other week, and he described the Romans to build the Colosseum had to burn down a forest to make enough concrete, which is a significant investment of time and effort, one that everyone involved in the process is actually able to see. Because we're shipping all that energy from the Middle East or Africa or wherever, we never have to look at it or think about it, so it doesn't matter. Yeah, yeah. Then we wrap the buildings in oil. So everything is derived of some kind of fossil fuel, whether it's transporting the materials or creating them in the first place. And even when you build a building out of these magnificent materials built from oil, the shite quality of the build is mitigated by an abundance of cheap energy to heat the place.
Yeah.
You can overheat the home because the ventilation is the poor quality of the build. So none of it matters. And now we've reached this point where, because we can see the effects of our emissions, carbon dioxide, paramounts, montgum, or the easiest to understand, perhaps. We have to scale all of that back and we have to rethink everything from resource use to resource misuse. And I think what you raised about the thinking about the impact on biodiversity is that's a really interesting emergent quality. So it's not just about reducing and reusing. I would argue that recycling is generally a bullshit as well. It's not really a real thing. It's a fig leaf.
And there's quite a lot of energy to do the recycling as well.
Exactly. Yeah. But this is it.
You're just taking the raw materials from where they came from rather than shipping them. Okay, you're saving on the shipping costs, but you still have to probably use a lot of heat to remake the glass or whatever it is.
It depends. It might be better than nothing, but it depends. You just need to number crunch it properly. You know,
it's a transition. It makes sense.
But this is the thing about number crunching, and we have the tool now. I mean, like, we all use Revit and we all use BIM to design our buildings, and all the pieces are there and they can be itemized and they can be calculated. I know contractors now do need to start selecting materials and they do need to start actually calculating this. If it is coming from Sweden or it's coming from China, it is going to have a higher carbon cost. Now, whether they're getting penalties or fines from it is, or tax for it is probably the further question on that. But it needs to be properly assessed, and it's kind of being done in a bit of a flimsy way to date.
Yeah.
And it's very complicated. I mean, a building has millions of parts. So, you know, the powers of technology are really going to need to help with that quantifying, but not beyond the realm of possibililities in terms of,
you know,
already using.
I would say, because we've been getting into embodied carbon calculation a lot in the magazine over the last couple of years, and learning more all the time about it. And, you know, there'll be imperfections in it, and there's loads of gaps that need plugging. But transport's a funny one. The more I learn about this as a subject, the more loath I am to kind of talk in terms of general truths or rules of thumb, because it's so often the case that that you'll get a finding that you thought, a view that you thought you've come to, and then you realize that that something trips it up. So in transport, for instance, some materials are being transported from, say, Sweden or wherever, may come with a very small carbon penalty. But if you've got like a heavy, bulky material that's being transported relatively short distances in a rigid truck, the carbon can rack up really, really quite quickly.
Well,
you know,
and I've had conversations with Richard in our office about this, and he feels quite strongly about it, but it's the timber versus concrete question. And everybody's banding around timber at the moment because it looks and it feels good. And yes, it is more sustainable if you're growing the timber locally, but actually we don't grow the timber locally. We don't grow enough timber locally in Ireland. There's building reg issues aside as to why we're not really building out of timber in any great scale. But even if we were to, concrete is actually the most used material across the world. And it's also we also produce it here in Ireland. So, I mean, CRH is one of the biggest concrete companies in the world. It's more that we probably need to get more sustainable on the materials that we are going to continue to use rather than try and reinvent the wheel and replace them with materials that we have to import from elsewhere.
There are sustainable uses of concrete. There, that industry has been.
What's it called? There is a sustainable concrete. Is it EcoSem?
Well, they make an alternative to Portland cement, which
I think it's a recycled material they use, though. So
Yeah, it's a byproduct of the steel smelting process, which is a polluting process. But the pollution is owned by the steel because the steel is going to be made anyway. It's got the wonderful name, the generic name, ground granulated blast furnace slag, which is a tough one to kind of try and market. Yes. But Ecosem has more of it.
GFRC, that's the one.
GGBS is theirs.
GGBS.
They've made a great headway over the last 20 years. What's interesting about them now is that because ultimately in the long run, steel, conventional steel production is going to change. It's going to have to because it's a high embodied carbon process. So they will end up in a situation where they'll have diminishing supply. So they've been doing an awful lot of work recently. And bloody Bill Gates invested in them. They're an amazing Irish success story, actually. And they've been working on how to reduce the cementitious content of concrete without diminishing its structural performance. So they're doing a really odd thing in the capitalist society, which is trying to work out how to sell less of their stuff to people. At present, the Ecosem's product has been the same price.
It's
the same price.
Yeah. Their success, or rather, they can only ever be a transition technology. Their lifespan. The thing is, with all of these, so you're absolutely right about we need to make more of the local concrete, but we need it to be better value use rather than profligate use as we are used to. And all of this stuff needs to be considered a transition technology if we're to move away from oil age architecture. So you're right, there's not enough timber produced locally.
And do you think ultimately timber is where it should go, or is there...
No, not necessarily. There needs to be the strategic use of a plethora of materials. There's no one size fits all in any of it.
Yeah, we're all looking for easy solutions, you know. And the truth is that there's like a hierarchy of questions I think that you need to ask with these things. I kind of loosely put this together with Andy Simmons, the CEO of the Association for Environment Conscious Building, and they're obvious. You know, like, first question: do you need to build at all?
Yeah.
Do you need to build here? Do you need to build this big, or can it be smaller? You know, and then there's a bunch of other ones that I'm missing out. What's the smallest amount of the least polluting resources we can use to build it for the most impact? You know, those kinds of things. And then all the kind of questions about adaptability and so on. So timber is an important material when used right, but people tend to oversimplify things. And then you end up with this kind of idea of people, certain architects, for instance, fetishizing mass timber and producing and claiming they've got a carbon negative building, which is just bollocks. So, you know, mass timber has its place again, but there are much better uses of timber, more sparing uses of timber to bigger impact in lower rise buildings, which should be done instead of mass timber, for instance. You know, I think on the concrete side, though, I'm still seeing some stories from some of the suppliers in the concrete industry being very reluctant, you know, to move away from Portland cement towards lower embodied carbon products and giving. I mean, I've seen examples recently of kind of nonsensical arguments from suppliers who should know better because they just don't want to change, and that's not good enough.
And that's the main reason for the profligate use. Like we spoke again, Kelly Alvarez Doran, he described building his cabin in the woods. He's a Canadian, so they all do that. all of them. And when he finally came around to doing carbon calculations, he realized what a carbon burden everything beneath the floor of the cabin was. I think that's where most of the carbon that was embodied in his construction had occurred. And when he looked back, he looked at his granddad's cabin that he'd built in the woods, and he'd just driven pile into the ground and built on that.
Was like, it still
just
sand?
Logs? Just logs lasted. Yeah. You know, was, years,
they
years,
were timber
years.
Piles. Yeah.
Yeah.
Venice is all built on timber piles.
Yeah, this shit lasts. It's just we got used to not having to think about it. That's the difference. We became suckered by oil age methodologies and strategies, and we didn't have.
There's
to
a problem in Ireland with the structural methodology. Like every building apparently is massively over designed. It's designed so that you could literally have people, as many people as you can fit in a building, shoulder to shoulder, which obviously will never happen. It's far over the actual allowed occupancy of the building, even from a fire perspective. And it's not even a building regulation thing, as I understand. I think it's actually driven by the market, that it's like a tick box that it needs to hit this certain structural strength, which is way beyond what it needs to be. So it's over designed by, you know, 4x or 5x. I mean, it's simple things like that.
They're more popular than they really are. They said they think they're going to have lots more people hang over, right, and they really will. Yeah.
Just back to, I suppose, the role of the architect in refurb. I find what's interesting about our role now, and you know, there might be a misconception historically about architects adding cost to buildings. So again, you know, a greenfield site, a new office, architects tend to charge a small percentage of the cost. Now what we're seeing is it's quite different. A client may not have a set budget and they're looking to us to sort of advise as to what the brief needs to be. And there's obviously large cost saving in that. So it's a really interesting process. I feel like we're more integral to the decision making at an early stage, and we're sort of saying to the client, like, listen, 7.5 meter grids, this is what you have, this is what you need to work with, it's not that big a deal. Or, you know, the slightly reduced floor to ceiling, you've got fantastic daylight, you've got narrower slabs, let's sort of locally create double height space, and advising like that. So it's I think it's changing, the role of the architects is changing, and I think that's a good thing, and there's definitely cost saving and obviously carbon saving in doing that as well.
That's really interesting. So like, you're, rather than just providing a service in terms of design, you're providing a strategic service in terms of not resolving a challenge necessarily, but helping your clients to appreciate what the challenge actually is.
I think so, because we don't know what a refurbed building looks like or what it needs to be. And we don't know how long that piece of string is. So we're trying to put our finger in the air. And in fairness, I think estate agents are having a good bit of involvement with that too, and saying, like, how far do we need to go to avoid this becoming a stranded asset? Mm. How far do we want to go, and what do we need to provide to ensure that it's hitting all the targets, but also creating something that the market wants to occupy?
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose what we're seeing is clients, potential clients, are coming to us early stage, either a client that might be selling an asset, or on the flip side, someone who's looking to buy it. And all of these buildings are usually quite different. Now, we see consistent themes across the categories. There's the historical buildings that usually are Georgian and Victorian. Then there's the, what I call the vintage buildings, that are kind of 70s, 80s, 90s. And they have consistent kind of issues, whether it's floor to ceiling heights, narrow floor plates, old plant, whatever it might be, replacing windows. And then there's the 10 to 15 year old more modern office blocks that might be a C or a D rating, that have quite deep floor plates. They don't have floor ceiling problems, but they might have been built for one tenant in mind and they need to be split up to multi-tenant. So there's consistent themes across them, but each building is very different. They might have different building systems. They might have different types of architecture or different layouts. So it's really early on going and talking and going and walking the building, seeing what it's like, getting a feel for it, and also getting, you know, structural engineers, M&E engineers, QSs. It only takes an hour or two to walk a building, and then having a conversation afterwards. And it's that kind of advisory role early on that we find is really key to making those projects work or not work.
Do you get many kind of glary, overheating office buildings? You know, I remember going in years ago to meet the facilities manager in Citibank, in the IFSC, and there was a swathe of a large chunk of that building that we couldn't use, or they couldn't use because of the glare. Massive expanse, south facing the Liffey, you know. And it was just remarkable to see this big corporation that had a building that was just not fit for purpose, so that they had to scuttle away from a massive chunk of it because the sun was shining.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's quite typical in a building like that. That would have been one of the more modern late 90s, early 2000s, I would say. I walked that building quite a few times last year or the year before when it was up for sale. And it was half empty. Well, it wasn't even half empty. I think there was about 50 people, and it's a building for possibly two or 3,000 people. And it also had very deep floor plates, and the cores were located on the outside, which made it quite challenging. But again, it's a big hulk of a structure of concrete, so you need to try and think of creative ways that you can not knock the whole thing down, but maybe carve out of it, find opportunities to increase density, find opportunities to bring more daylight in where it's needed, and then protect from the daylight, as you're saying, where it's needed, so that it's not making it so uncomfortable. And that's the thing. I mean, in our climate, we are an older building and there is AC, but we only use the AC like 2 weeks of the year, when it's like, you know, 25 degrees, and that's our heat wave for 2 weeks of the summer in July. So yeah. Having AC in the Irish climate is a requirement, I think, because of maybe bad design.
And yeah.
No, I think tenants want it for thermal comfort. And obviously, you've got a lot of people going into one room. You're going to need AC. But it just seems in our climate that fully air-conditioned spaces across the entire building is a bit overkill.
Yeah, I think it's people getting distracted, focusing on the means rather than the end, rather than the outcome. You know, but what you want is a comfortable building, right? So it's, again, through our inability to kind of express that in simple terms for people.
One of the things I remember speaking about last year was looking at these troublesome buildings and what you just described, thinking creatively about them, like from considering the flood risk. So the less permanent space on the bottom, which can still be the showcase space for a thing to attract people. But considering
the big thing now is a requirement for a cultural and community use. Actually, it's a planning requirement. And
really?
I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
it's 5%. For any building over 10,000 square meters.
Well, just for new builds, though.
For new builds. But if you're doing a big, deep retrofit like that and you're going for planning, they probably might want to talk to you about putting something in. I mean, the one that tends to be the go-to is the artist studios, which is absolutely needed. But there needs to be a creative thought process between the local council, the developer, the needs of the local area in terms of what kind of cultural and community space is appropriate, whether...
Any crashes, right? I mean, what about that?
I wouldn't really call them cultural use, but there is a huge demand.
No, I know they're not cultural, but it's just, to enable people to not have to drive around the country, to just go about their daily activity, you know.
And then that attracts people to come into the office if they know that there's a crash. Maybe they could bring their child with them on their commute and... They go to Chris, bring it to work. Yeah.
This sort of thinking about using, like, because it doesn't necessarily have to be artist studios. It could be other creative uses of a space. You mix, like, I'm minded to think of the infamous, ill-fated, mythologized Bedzed project, where they had people living, where other people were working in this utopian paradise outside of London, which it didn't quite work, but... The thinking was right. And I think what you described in that sort of mixed-use space, you know, restaurant, communal space, ground floor, excellent. Artist spaces, middle territory. So you can stick a cinema in or studios.
But even nightclubs and cinemas and, exhibition space, the list could go on. You know, Temple Bar in Dublin was originally meant to be a cultural community hub. And the reason it ended up that way, which is an interesting story. I'm kind of sidetracking a bit, but I do have a point. The reason was because Busar has bought up all of the, it was kind of a backlands derelict part of the city. It was, you know, almost dangerous. No one would go there. They bought up all the plots of land and old buildings, and then they leased them out at a peppercorn rent. And they were going to come up with a grand plan to build a very large bus depot. And then who moved in but all the artists and all the bohemian types. And then by the time they got plans with this big bus depot, they all protested and said, hold on, putting that here is ridiculous. We've got a cultural hub here now. We need to embrace that. So that's the story behind Temple Bar. And I just think it's that kind of use is now getting driven out a little bit by commercial uses because the prices go up. The city and development community or the property industry and the asset owners need to allow for that. They're not going to make a huge amount of money, but they need space. And it's important that their space is within the city and it's not getting driven.
This stuff does need to be protected. I think if this sort of thinking is baked into the strategy that you are selling and presenting to your customers, like, I think that's a really positive thing because you're creating long-term asset value, community value. Like what we learn from the shocks to the value of office building assets is that they are no longer secure as they once were. And it's not just the value of that particular asset, it's the whole economic system, ecosystem that surrounds it. You know, we in the UK, we were being urged to go and spend money in Pret, or we were being urged to return to the office to keep Pret afloat. Fuck off, pricks. Like, who do they think we are? Why should we be responsible for that? Like, the consolidation of all these things to deliver shareholder value to a precious few. Fuck off. Like, what we should be doing is developing sustainable economic systems that deliver value for people. Now, when you put artists in places where there are homes, like, man, the value of those places will rise. That is the cycle of gentrification. You see it in New York from the 70s through to the 80s. Like, you saw it in East London through the 90s. Where I live now, I'm part of the latest wave of gentrification in Hastings and St. Leonard's. Like, we were drawn here. It's a bit bougie over in St. Leonard's. I was talking to the lady who owns the independent cheese shop down the road, talking about the area I've moved into, St. Helens, it's known as.
It's pretty expensive cheese.
Well, oh man, it's dear, but it is utterly fabulous. If you ever find yourself in Hastings, check Cheese on Sea in the America grounds. It is brilliant. Ruth is top draw. But like, when she described the people who'd moved into our area as people who moved down from London who had media and marketing jobs, like, she looked at me with an arched eyebrow. Like, fair play to her. You know, I am part of this cycle. But there should be something done within planning for commercial activity, residential activity, which protects the local culture or fosters something much more meaningful. And I think this mixed-use approach that you described, you know, that creates resilient local economies. So when people are forced to stay home, because COVID isn't the only shock that we're ever going to have. Like, whilst we have been told to forget there's a pandemic, it never actually went away. I know some people are delighted to think that it stopped, but like, people are still dying.
There's millions of other viruses lurking in the melting, in the all the dead animals that are thawing now for the permafrost and stuff, you know. Yeah,
oh, all them pathogens.
All ahead of us.
Yeah. Like, this shit's gonna carry on.
But is that, and to loop it back to the office again, I mean, the trend that is settling post pandemic, and it accelerated it quicker than it was already happening. People were already working remotely, but now they are indefinitely working remotely a part of the week. And it seems to be settling at Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, which I know the acronym I hope isn't too offensive, but it is the TWAT.
I'll say TWAT.
The TWATs. Yeah. But that is having a real effect on office buildings, number one. It's having effect on then if you've got the local sandwich shop near the office building, and now you're only getting 3 days business when you used to get 5. So it's having an effect both on the building scale and then on the neighborhood scale. I mean, then it will have a reverse effect in the suburbs where people are working from home, or in the neighborhoods where people are working from home, so that the cafes there might do more business on those other days. But it's just the whole dynamic of the city is being put into a magnifying glass. Dublin in particular is a very suburban city, so you can really see it on Mondays and Fridays in the more business areas. It's totally quiet. Pubs are now busy on Thursday nights rather than Friday nights. I'm sure it's the same around London. Commuting is really the enemy of it all. People don't want to waste time sitting in a car or sitting on a train for hours and hours a day, which is fair enough.
But I think, all right, so as we should probably wind up, although we could carry on. I think we will continue this conversation another time, I'm sure. So putting ourselves in the shoes of the asset owners, how should they be thinking about their future? You've produced a piece of content, Maximizing
Building Use, it's called. I suppose it's a bit of a white paper / marketing tool, but really we're looking at the issue of maximizing existing building use. And as we said, I think 85% of existing office buildings in Ireland are below a B energy rating. They are not going to just be knocked down anymore. So that's the fundamental challenge that's facing the industry. But, you know, just anecdotally, anytime you're talking to clients or other industry partners, it's the hot topic of the day, I think. So we've shown some examples of buildings that we've done in the categories that we've already kind of spoken about. But we're hoping to kind of do a little bit of a soft launch on it over the next few weeks and talk to some of our clients, get some informal feedback, and then probably try and release it more formally into the public ether in a few months.
But as a piece of content, you're laying out the facts around the future of this type of building asset. you know, like highlighting the fact that Energy Performance Directive is going to change the landscape. And that's without ever even talking about things like embodied carbon and the implications that will have for not refurbishment, but for renewal of the building stock from the ground up, meaning that retrofit is going to be increasingly on the agenda, whether people like it or not.
Well, it is bridging that gap between the operational and the embodied carbon. I mean, that's the gap that we see that's kind of been ignored. You know, everybody's been doing well, I think, improving the energy performance of new buildings, getting LEED Platinum or BREEAM or whatever the plaque that might prove it. But the embodied carbon story, I think, had been kind of lost, and it's now time to try and get that bit to catch up.
Yeah, like it's a nice piece of content. Like, it lays out some of the facts. It points people in the direction of thinking about the potential use of the building for the future and how they should be thinking about it. So like laying out the opportunities, how to think about appraising the building stock, and you show them a few case studies. Now, this is quite a marketing document, but this is like you're making the more hardcore research that you've done accessible.
A lot of that was thanks to Richard, who you guys know.
Big up Richard.
He's done a lot of research in that field, which has been great. But maybe just to counter that a little bit, I think while the research and the sort of longer term sustainability goals are very important, we also see there being, like, this is an opportunity for offices and tenants to rethink what they're about, where they want to be in the city, and what they want to be about. So, like, I think this is a great opportunity for a tenant. You know, they're no longer shackled to the fact that they need to provide seats for every staff member. A lot of the larger consulting and accounting firms have bedded that into their briefs for new developments. And they're working to the fact that their staff will be in the office 3 days a week. Now, their space requirements may not actually decrease that much, but it changes the nature of what their building is about. So I think it's an exciting time for the next office or the office of the future, and what that actually looks like and what sort of values they want to instill in that. And we just see the piece about reusing existing buildings. They might be beautiful old buildings, they might be less beautiful newer buildings. We're trying to bring that through to tenants and to sort of sell that as an add to what their new building is. And it's definitely growing. I think we've been talking about this for about a year and a half. We've seen some movement and some clients doing it. We've done it over the past maybe 8 years since Bagot Plaza, but definitely in the past 6 months, 9 months, there's been an increase in developers taking the leap and saying, do you know what, let's do this. Let's do a big refurb. Let's talk to tenants. Let's see what they want. And let's get this building ready for its next stage. So that's exciting. So I think there's a lot of things happening, but it's definitely an opportunity for us to reimagine what the office is all about.
That's a really positive thing. I think this is a subject we're going to be returning to quite frequently. What I found really interesting about the conversation today is we actually, in our divergence away from rethinking about refurbishing offices, we actually got into talking about rethinking the role of the architect. Indirectly. So, you know, landing at that point where, oh, all of a sudden it becomes a strategic role, where one would think that is what an architect did anyway.
I think we always did it. I think it's just when refurb comes to the fore, it becomes more evident. So when there's a new building, everybody knows what needs to go into a new building within reason. I think when there's big decisions to be made about, do we keep the facade or do we not? I think the responsibility often lies with the architect to say, lads, this is mental. Like, the facade's got 20, 30 years left in it. Why would we replace it? This is ego talking. You know, we can give you your identity piece somewhere else, but it would be criminal to take that out for the sake of it. So it's decisions like that that I think are becoming more important. And I think it's a good thing that the architects sort of had that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was something Sarah Edmonds used to say. So former co-host now, I mean, man, she's all sorts of things.
It's the things, yeah.
National Retrofit Director at best, yeah. She's co-chair of the, or co-director at Natural Retrofit Hub. She wears many hats, one of the founding members of ACAN, blah, blah, blah. Like, she's brilliant. But she used to say something, and I'm paraphrasing it and putting my own flex on it, but like, real architects build nout. Like, you don't have to build anything to be a good architect. Like, when you look around you at what the role of an architect should be in the future, 8% of the building stock that we're going to have by 2050 already exists, etc. Like, that number goes up and down depending where you are, but it's still really massive. And that suggests that we should be tinkering with the stuff we've got rather than recreating. So that you're able to see a future where you take a more strategic role and guide people rather than just being reactive. Man, I hope that works, because it's got to.
Yeah, well, it's all about people, really. I mean, for us, architecture is about a people-first approach. You know, there's the fun of, we always get lost in the buildings and the technical part and making it look really beautiful, which is part of it. But ultimately, it's about making spaces that are functional for people and for people to work, live, and enjoy. So that's the fundamental principle that we always try to bring back in terms of how we approach any building project, whether it's an existing or a new building. So
that's a surprising rarity of an approach.
As part of that, do you get stuck into the nerdy stuff around quantifying and validating performance on things like indoor environmental quality, like temperature and humidity and
do it ourselves,
indoor air quality and so on? Yeah,
that's what we preach. So we've sort of quantified that and checked that in our own offices. People think they're being booked when they come into a meeting because there's a little thing on the table checking.
Those sensors on the table, yeah.
But it's an interesting one. I think the post-occupancy piece is probably missed a lot, and it's not as successfully integrated into the, you know, the lifespan of the building as we'd like, because it involves, I suppose, you know, the package of works, designing, delivering, handing over is quite neat, and the piece about staying involved and coming back 5 years later is less defined. But I think the comfort in place is a good precedent for where that worked out for everybody, because you could see how the building can operate better and win-win. We have a better operating building. And like, I think we mentioned it today and it comes up all the time, like the role of the facilities manager and the role of that ongoing sort of transparent appraisal of how your building's actually operating is so important, rather than just
proactive or active operational maintenance.
Yeah.
Like, it beggars belief how maintenance itself is just a reactive process in most organizations.
Yeah. And in most buildings.
Yeah, it just costs more as well. Yeah.
We mentioned that company Symphony to you, but I mean, that's just amazing, an amazing system. That it's a smart system that plugs into BMS and it actively tries to make the HVAC system of the building more efficient. So it doesn't, if nobody's in the room, it'll turn off. I mean, it's just a simple enough idea, but it'll also take the excess heat in a room that's full and then try to use that to cool another room, for example. I'll butcher the explanation of the engineering, but it basically is able to drive the performance of existing buildings by a further 70-80%, for example.
That's amazing. All right, so we better wrap up because we're going long. Do you guys have anything to plug? What I will ask is, send me a bunch of the notes, that the things that we referred to, case studies for, I think you mentioned Bagot Place, was it? Like, any of the case studies?
Yeah, Stein House, I suppose, is one that was recently completed for a company called, for a developer called iPut, and that's was recently more in the ether. That was an existing building refurb with tenants in place, so, and looks quite well. The research piece, I suppose, is something that is going to be something that we're going to release now over the next few weeks or possibly month or two.
I think we're sort of keen to keep this bit of the business growing because we believe in it, and we've sort of seen it coming down the tracks for a couple of years. It's inevitable. I think buildings will become stranded. That's okay. Our job as the architect is sort of growing, and we sort of love that. And we get to see what the next office looks like, how certain buildings can be changed into a different use, and how some are suitable for staying as office. And I think it's important to be a proponent for the office. Like, we come into the office every day. We believe in the office. We love the office. I think lots of people do. And the office definitely isn't dead.
A general plug for ourselves, that we're open to look at any opportunities for these brown to green office refurbs.
Cool. All right.
Brilliant.
Well, we'll make sure everything gets in the show notes. When the maximizing building use piece is on public release, We'll add it to the show notes, send a link our way, and I'd be happy to publish it on the LinkedIn channel so it appears, because I think it's a really thought-provoking piece of work, like easily accessible.
Yep.
Importantly, I think I really want to get into this. I was speaking with the head of building standards at Rick's, and this is something, the nature of commercial space, like in terms of retrofit, we've done loads of work on domestic sector. We've talked it to death. Like, we all know all about that. I mean, we know exactly what needs to be done. It's just no one's got the money to do it. That's the big challenge that we face now. So we're looking at alternative approaches to make it accessible. But so little has been spoken of in the commercial space. There's so little discourse about it that's accessible, that's meaningful, that highlights any sort of direction, that we really need to get people talking about it more, because it's been an easy one to ignore because I think it's just been too hard.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, and for, like, as we said earlier, you know, housing is more important than offices in terms of need. But that doesn't mean that offices don't need to change too.
It's not even just offices. There's another plug for us, is that we do work across quite a few sectors. So particularly the industrial sector, education sector, they're all realizing the same thing, that they can't just knock it down and rebuild. I was walking a site, I won't mention which one, but it was kind of an old tech campus type of site at the outskirts of Dublin. The company still has 800 staff on site, and there's a new owner. They want to consolidate some of their workers into one building, which is all, you know, the building's already dated. They're old, big industrial shed type buildings, so they need a bit of work in terms of trying to upgrade them. Then there's about, you know, a few other buildings that are going to be left over, and what could they be? And again, they don't want to just knock them and rebuild. It's about reinventing them, reusing them. And then if there's going to be possibly less people, then turning some of the car parking into landscaping, making it a nicer environment, all that. Then we'd also work with some of the higher level education campuses here, you know, UCD being a big one. And again, we've done some projects with them where we reuse, for example, the old science blocks. That's there are projects that are ongoing. Well, one of the wings of the block was completed about 10 years ago, and then we're continuing on further phases of that. So again, reusing the existing structure, putting new labs in. So it's, I'm not sure what the entire metric of domestic versus non-domestic buildings are, but I think they're possibly on par. So the challenge is equally as big, and it does spread across sectors.
Well, this is it. We need to be talking about it properly, more publicly. I'm going to call time.
Just a parting gift. I started watching The Office. I'm not sure if anyone watches The American Office. And Michael Scott, the other night, was watching it. There's a great scene where he buys a painting from Pam, his secretary. And it's a really shitty painting of their office in Scranton Business Park. But he looks up at it, and she was painting in the office, and a little tear comes to his eye, and he's like, that's our building. We sell paper. And I don't know what it was, but it just sort of struck me that, like, you know, he has pride in it. You know, the office is important. It's who they are. Dunder Mifflin Paper Company, shitty little grey box on the outskirts of Scranton. And yeah, it's his pride and joy. So,
well, yeah, I think that's a cultural issue. Something that has been sorely lacking from so many. Right, Jeff, you got anything to plug?
I've got a leg it or I'll be in trouble.
Cool. Yeah. All right, no problem. All right, well, thank you very much for your time today, fellas.
It's all right. Really interesting. Thanks a million.
Thanks a million,
Jeff.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Chat again soon. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Everyone at home, join ACAN, join the ACB, join the IGBC. Women, check her own space. All of it's in the show notes. Subscribe to Passive House Plus. Advertise if you can. Do you guys advertise? Okay, yeah. Oh, man, Jeff's got space for you. You should stay on.
You can email us after.
And what else do we do? Talk to us about the consultancy. Give us a shout if you're interested in talking about any of this stuff that we talked about today. Feedback's always welcome. Oh, and please review it, share it, like it, wherever you happen to be enjoying it. And if you can't be asked with any of that, don't. Fine. We're just delighted you are listening. Thank you. All right. Cheers, everyone. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. See you. Bye-bye.